morning, and may it please the court. My name is Gary Ettinger. I represent the appellant Club Madonna, Inc. With me this morning is Dan Aronson, my co-counsel. I hope we have an interesting argument to present to the court today. The appeal is a little bit different in two respects. One of them is it's really two appeals kind of glommed together that have almost nothing to do with each other than common litigants. We have a due process challenge that was decided below on the merits. An order granting motion to dismiss is the subject of that appeal. We also have a number of constitutional challenges and interesting preemption challenges to something referred to as Miami Beach's human trafficking ordinance. That was dismissed on jurisdictional grounds for ripeness. And so not only—
Let me ask you this question up front. In your brief, you make much of the fact that you contend the district court in this case considered matters improperly outside the four corners of the complaint. And this is on a motion to dismiss that Judge Marino granted. Tell us specifically what you say he considered on a motion to dismiss that he should not have considered, and maybe this would have been better had it been a motion for summary judgment.
Yes, Your Honor. We had really two concerns about the fact-finding. One I'm going to answer directly, which is what were the matters d'ores the record, but just generally that there was fact-finding that we maintain was inappropriate for a motion to dismiss.
Fact-finding about what?
In particular, there was the history of the exigent circumstances. Involved a lot of findings of fact that we see in the order that were not in the complaint. They were taken from the motion to dismiss. Also some matters having to do with the post-deprivation remedies. So very much about the emergency. Was there an emergency? Did the passage of time make a difference? But also the court had findings, for instance, that there were negotiations by the parties, and those negotiations are what led to the city to reinstate the license. Also that in terms of the fact that the hearing, the administrative hearing, ultimately didn't go through, the trial court ascribes to the plaintiffs waiving or abandoning. There are also some findings of fact with respect to that the plaintiff could have and should have asked for a more expedited hearing. So these are matters, they're not d'ores the record. I'm gonna address that question specifically. But there are findings of fact that we see in the order that clearly weren't taken from the complaint. They were taken verbatim from the motion to dismiss. And they're not legal matters. They are matters of fact which make a great deal of difference in how the case would resolve. They're also contested facts, the kind of thing that we would have liked to have an opportunity to present some facts in rebuttal. Your Honor, in answering your specific question about matters d'ores the record, they had to do with attachments to the motion to dismiss. And they consisted of primarily a search warrant and the affidavit in support.
But don't we have case law in this circuit, and don't we have an incorporation by reference doctrine that specifically says that a district court may consider external documents outside the four corners of the complaint without converting it to a motion for summary judgment?
We sure do, Judge, but it's also a very limited doctrine. So what it tells us is that when we do look at matters that are attachments, factual matters, they have to be referenced in the complaint, and they have to be central to the cause of action in some respect. And so the particular search warrant with the affidavit information that came with it and some video, I believe, was submitted. These are matters that were not specifically addressed in the complaint. What the complaint talks about is—
Well, doesn't the complaint specifically reference the search warrant?
It does.
And wouldn't you agree that the search warrant is central to what happened here? I mean, that seems to be the triggering event for everything.
The search warrant is not irrelevant, and it is the triggering or starting event. But what is significant about that is really what happened afterwards and what the police did in response and how that plays into the idea of exigent circumstances. From our perspective, the fact that the underlying issue was whether an underage performer was allowed to dance nude at Club Madonna. So that is a serious thing, and we're not belittling that at all. And it is something that would legitimately draw the interest of government and in a really direct, immediate way. What we allege is a search warrant was executed. It doesn't really matter why it was, but it was executed.
But I think it does matter why it was executed. And the reason it matters is because the ordinance is geared to address the specific problems. For example, that not only was this performer underage, but also that she wasn't even permitted to keep her own earnings because her earnings weren't being paid directly to her. And so the ordinance, for example, requires that earnings be paid directly to performers, that two forms of identification be shown. And so it seems to me like the ordinance itself is geared to address everything that was the basis for the search warrant.
When I indicated that the cases had nothing to do with one another, that's not entirely true, because it is fair to say that the human trafficking ordinance came out of this event. So it's not like the event played no part in the city's deliberations, and we readily acknowledge that fact. But in terms of how the search warrant plays into the allegations, and in particular the due process concerns we raise in this case, we talk about exigent circumstances. So one of the things that I hope is interesting about this appeal is we don't have a whole lot of case law in our circuit and really elsewhere as to what is an emergency. What we have alleged here is that there may have been an emergency, and we know where it was defined in time, and we also know when that emergency was ameliorated. And that turns on the search warrant, on the day that the search warrant was executed. What we've asserted in the complaint, and what we have maintained that the trial court was obligated to accept as fact because it was well pled and not implausible, is that the police conducted their search. The underage performer who may have been in the club had been removed previously. She was not allowed to obviously dance again. That the police conducted a due diligence investigation, as they should, that there were no indication that there were other underage performers, and that no one from Club Madonna, none of the management staff, none of the owners or principals were charged or cited with any crime. There were no civil proceedings that resulted other than the revocation issue. And so that was concluded on January 6, 2014. We also allege, and this would be highly significant and also goes a little bit to the human trafficking ordinance, that Club Madonna did immediately adopt remedial measures, as a responsible business ought to do when presented with the possibility they did something really, really wrong.
Yeah, but counsel, that doesn't mean the city has to defer to Club Madonna's remedy. And the fact that that particular dancer was removed doesn't vitiate the need that the city could have felt for ensuring that it didn't happen again.
Yes, Your Honor. And so we address that in two ways. Firstly, there's the issue of pretext, which we alleged with great detail in the complaint, because there is a history of animosity between these parties, a great
there
deal
There may be, but I don't understand that you're making any serious suggestion here that there was pretext about an underage dancer.
Not that part, Your Honor. And I think the city could believe in good faith, and obviously a judge believed, because the city, a law enforcement agency, had applied for a search warrant and obtained it. So there was probable cause to believe. And so to that level of proof, we're not questioning that fact at all. What we are pointing to is that there was a period of days that went by during which the city took no action, and which we maintain and have explained in the complaint, the exigent circumstances were no longer present.
Well, the city didn't know whether the exigent circumstances were still present or not. They knew that that the club had allowed this to happen, and they knew how very bad that was. And they weren't required to say, but it's been a while, maybe they've cleaned everything up.
Right. Yes, sir, but the city can't act irresponsibly, particularly when due process says that in almost every circumstance we have to have that pre-deprivation notice and a hearing.
Well, see, let me just tell you up front. I want to tell you where your problem is with me, and only I'm speaking only for me, with the procedural due process violations, all of them. They're barred by McKinney. You had the opportunity to pursue your remedies in the state courts after an appeal, a post-deprivation hearing, among other things, and then either appeal or certiorari from there to the state court system, and you didn't do it. And I mean, that's the heart of McKinney.
Your Honor, the district court did devote a paragraph to that, sort of as
a... I don't care how many paragraphs it devoted about it. It held it as an alternative holding. It could have put an alternative holding in a footnote to an appendix to its decision. It still held that, and it seems to me that that decision is correct. And I want you to tell me why McKinney doesn't bar all of your procedural due process claims.
I would say, Your Honor, in two respects it does not. We asserted facial challenges that said basically that given the requirements of fundamental due process, on its face, this ordinance did not comply with those requirements. And secondarily, the Supreme Court has acknowledged that there can be such thing as an as-applied due process challenge, where even if the ordinance looked good on paper and that remedies are theoretically available through state court, that the way they were applied in this particular instance did violate due process.
And McKinney says the way you vindicate that is through the established, recognized, and upheld procedural remedies that are provided in state court, and that if you don't take advantage of those, which specifically to Florida we've held are adequate, then you're out of court, not because of any demerits, but other than the merits on the procedural due process. The whole theory behind McKinney is you have a procedural remedy, and it is adequate. No merit to your claim. Go to state court and pursue that remedy. That's what McKinney holds.
I definitely understand Your Honor's point, but again, I would point to cases such as Fuentes versus Chevin that one when faced with what are some manner of state court proceedings, the Supremes have nonetheless allowed a due process argument to go forward when those proceedings are plainly inadequate.
And they're not. Why are they plainly inadequate? We've held as a matter of binding precedent. It was en banc decision. We've held that the Florida remedies are adequate.
Well, certainly they are in certain aspects, such as attachment, which was the interest in Fuentes. But in this case, what we've pointed to in terms of the inadequacy are the fact that there's not an adequate cabining of discretion with respect to declaration of an emergency,
Your remedy for that is to, depending on whether the city manager is covered by the administrative code or not, is to appeal directly from his post-deprivation decision to the DCA, or if it's a cert proceeding, to the state circuit court. That's your remedy. It's not that there's no violation, it's that you have a remedy for the violation, and therefore there's no violation as a whole in the entire proceeding.
I understand Your Honor's point.
I won't take any more of your time on that issue.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. I have just a couple seconds left. I'm going to very briefly address the ripeness issue in rebuttal. For now, I'm just going to say that we maintain the court got it wrong based on this burden shifting that the court thought was the trigger for ripeness. And I will devote about a minute or so of that in rebuttal. Thank you.
Chief, do you have anything further?
No.
May it please the court. Enrique Arana, on behalf of the City of Miami Beach, and with me at council table is Rachel Lusendorp.
Let me ask you an open question before I lose track of it on the McKinney issue. Is the office of the city manager covered by the Administrative Procedure Act of Florida?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Okay, it would be good to know the answer to that, but I don't want to take any more of your time for that. There are two tracks for appealing procedural due process violations and remedying them in state court. One is if you're subject to the APA, the plaintiff can seek judicial review in the State District Court of Appeals, the DCA. And you're not subject to APA, it's the state certiorari proceeding in circuit court.
Your Honor, yes. That's something that we haven't briefed, and we can certainly supplement if Your Honor would like supplementation on that point.
If we do, we'll ask for it.
Your Honors, Club Adon was closed for 17 days after a joint Miami-Dade County State Attorney and City of Miami Police Department investigation discovered evidence that a 13-year-old child victim of human trafficking had been forced to dance at the club on five separate occasions in November and December of 2013. The district court's decision should be affirmed because it correctly held that the city's actions in safeguarding the public and children from human trafficking did not violate the club's due process rights.
Let me ask you the same question I ask opposing counsel, and I'll tell you up front, this case, I don't think there's much to it, but I am concerned a bit about the fact that the appellant argues in its brief that Fred Marino did two things wrong. One, he engaged in fact-finding, which he should not have done. And second, that he improperly considered matters outside the four corners of the complaint, and we're dealing here with a motion to dismiss. What do you have to say about that?
Your Honor, the court properly considered the documents attached to the motion to dismiss. And just to be clear, the complaint, there's really enough in the complaint to support the judge's ruling, because the complaint alleges that there was a police investigation into whether a minor was dancing at Club Madonna. The complaint alleges at paragraph 25 that a search warrant was issued based on evidence that that was happening. The complaint alleges that a temporary closure order was entered on paragraph 30, and the complaint alleges that 17 days later, that closure order was lifted by the city. So the motion to dismiss attached two documents, essentially, that they're complaining about. One is the search warrant, which is referenced in the complaint, which includes an affidavit outlining what happened to this minor, a 13-year-old dancing at the club. And we also attached the revocation order, which shows that the city lifted the closure 17 days after closing the club upon reaching agreement with the club regarding security procedures to make sure that something like that didn't happen again.
And so you say in your brief, then, the district court could correctly consider those documents under this incorporation by reference doctrine?
Absolutely. Under the incorporation by reference doctrine, also because they're public records.
Can I turn your attention to the claims that were dismissed on ripeness grounds?
Yes, Your Honor.
So setting aside the Eighth Amendment and Fourth Amendment claims, the other claims, and I think the vagueness one, there's a good standing argument, though the district court dismissed it on ripeness, not standing, right?
Correct.
Okay, so I'm not sure there's a good ripeness argument. I think there might be a good standing argument there. But the other ones, why isn't it enough that the club is complying with the new ordinance and it is costing it money to do so? It's costing it money from its profits. Why isn't that injury enough for, and especially when we're talking about what are plainly just legal issues that don't require factual development?
Well, I think two things. The standard under Sheffer versus Reno is whether the claim is fit for review, and second, whether review, so withholding review would work a substantial hardship. And what the case has made clear is that a case is fit for review if the ordinance has been applied or enforced in some way. You do need a concrete case.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt, but do you need to show a hardship if, in other words, do we require citizens to actually flout the regulation or the ordinance in order to be able to challenge it if all that is involved is a legal question and if they are otherwise incurring an injury? So, for example, here the injury alleged is that it's costing them money to comply, that they are complying, it's costing them money to comply, and they raise purely legal issues. So what other development would we need to see of the claim when they're raising they're raising a facial challenge and they're raising it on a legal issue only?
Well, the case law is clear, for example, in the case of a First Amendment challenge, that in order to bring a pre-enforcement First Amendment challenge, the plaintiff would have to show that that withholding review would work a hardship because there's self-censorship involved. In other words, that the ordinance restricts First Amendment expression in some way. So,
for example, I think those are different kinds of ordinances, right? I mean, those are ordinances that are regulating the content of speech, and this ordinance here is not regulating speech itself. It's regulating, you know, how they keep their books and how they hire people.
Yes, Your Honor, but the claim is a First Amendment challenge.
true.
So in order to show that a pre-enforcement challenge is ripe, they need to show that the ordinance is in fact interfering in some way with their protected expression.
So they have to either violate the law or, I mean, they pretty much have to violate the law or shut down, is what you're saying.
It would have to be enforced against them. If it's enforced against them.
Can you just focus on this question? Would they have to do one of two things, either violate the law or close down because they can't comply with the ordinance requirements?
In this context, they would have to violate the law and have it enforced against them.
Is that something we want to do, though? I mean, I can understand why we would require that if, for example, we needed further factual development, if the ordinance were not clear how it applied, or, you know, if there were some kind of as-applied challenge, obviously. But why do we need to do that? Why do we need to force them to violate the statute, the ordinance, if there's no, I mean, it doesn't seem like there's any further factual development that will help us to be able to determine whether preemption applies and the other claims as well, which raise purely legal issues.
Well, because I think before the court will address a constitutional question, it needs to be presented with a concrete case. And that is the ripeness doctrine. And so they can get there one of two ways. They can show that they are acting in a way that requires enforcement, or there is enforcement. And by the way, this action was brought some 23 months after the ordinance was enacted.
Okay, but what other factual development would you need? Like, how would it help us to determine whether preemption applies?
Well, for example, if there's an enforcement action that decides whether or not they have properly checked IDs or the right forms of ID, whether they have verified them. By the way, the requirements of this ordinance are very simple. And they're very reasonable. But two forms of ID, verifying that that's
accurate. I'm not arguing about that, but I'm just wondering what else they would have to, what kind of factual development here would help us to decide these purely legal issues?
Well, I think that the claims are both facial and as applied, and the court would need a concrete case to determine whether or not the club's in violation of a particular provision of the ordinance. And in the meantime, there's no hardship.
But
in terms of their constitutional rights.
Okay, but on the facial challenges, what other factual development would help us to decide these claims? I don't want to keep beating a dead horse. Sure. If you don't have an answer to that, that's okay. I just am trying to figure that out.
Right. For example, in order to determine a facial challenge, if the ordinance is can be applied in one case, or in this particular case, lawfully or constitutionally, then the facial challenge fails. And so it would be helpful to have a concrete case to decide whether, in fact, the ordinance is constitutional as applied to the plaintiffs. And so I think...
But that's as applied. So
correct.
Facially.
Correct. But if it can be applied in any particular case, then it's constitutional. And we would submit that having a concrete case before the court to address that issue would be helpful. And that's what the case law requires.
Counsel, let me ask you something. You said the ordinance is very easy to comply with.
Yes.
The club, as I understand it, every time an employee enters the establishment, must require and check two forms of identification.
Correct.
So every day when everybody comes to work, you got to make them present two forms of identification.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so if one of the employees goes out to the car to get some cigarettes or because she forgot her purse or whatnot, you got two forms of identification coming in.
Well, I don't know that it would apply in that case. But
well, that's what it says every time an employee enters the establishment.
Right. Well,
so, I mean, that doesn't. I mean, come on.
Well, and I think that's an example, Your Honor, of a concrete case that would be useful in deciding whether the statute would be constitutional, or sorry, the ordinance would be constitutional as applied in that particular case.
So that's absolute requirement. I mean, you're spared seeing me today, but I have gray hair, my share of age spots. Nobody would mistake me for a 17-year-old, but if I worked there, obviously not as a dancer, but if I worked there, they'd have to, okay, Judge Rosenbaum, they would have to check two forms of identification every time I walked in the door?
The reason I think that's so important, Your Honor, is that what we're talking about...
Well, the question's important, but the answer then is yes, right?
Yes, that's correct. A performer, someone who goes into that club to dance in the nude has to provide two forms of ID every time she appears so that the club can verify...
It doesn't say every employee who dances in the nude, does it? I thought it said every employee.
Workers or performers, correct.
Yeah, so a janitor comes in to clean the floor. You got to check two forms of ID.
Correct.
And then clubs must obtain a sworn statement from the owners or managers confirming that each employee is at least 18 years old and working voluntarily. How do you confirm that?
Well, confirming that's fairly simple. And again, the ordinance is directed towards performers and waitresses and staff and other folks that need to be of age in order to perform there.
It may be directed towards it, but it covers everybody. And regardless of whether it covers everybody or not, the people it covers, how do you confirm that somebody is at least 18 years old?
You ask for their two forms of ID.
How do you confirm that they're there voluntarily?
You ask them.
And so if somebody is forced to dance naked in a club like that at a underage state, then they won't be forced to tell you that they're of age?
Well, the club is directed to verify that and confirm it. And the only way they can
simple, counsel. You said it's simple. I want to see how they can simply confirm that someone is there voluntarily.
I think what they do is they ask the performer or the worker, are you here of your own free will or somebody making you do this? That is the bare minimum you can expect of a club that's in this business, given the prevalence of trafficking and given the paramount interest at stake. The club should ask the performer. And in fact, the order lifting the revocation, which was attached to the motion to dismiss, made that crystal clear. It said that the club should confirm and ask the performer to acknowledge
you understand that confirm and ask is different than ask.
Well, I think that is what the club can do under the circumstances.
That's not what the ordinance says.
Well, it says they should confirm it.
Yeah, I know it, but it doesn't say they should ask, or they may confirm by asking.
Well,
I'm just challenging your question, and you shouldn't overstate your case that this is easy to comply with. It's not easy to comply with, particularly with all the questions that go with it. Now, you may be able to comply with it, or the difficulties may be justified or not unconstitutional in the circumstances, but that's a different thing than saying it's easy.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, I think that it complies with constitutional requirements, but more importantly, if you look at the system that's put in place here, that the club agreed to in 2014 to reopen, simply requires the club to take reasonable measures to make sure that something like this doesn't happen again. The club allowed a 13-year-old child to dance at the club. That is reprehensible, and there needs to be a system in place to make sure that doesn't happen again. The city took reasonable measures. It closed the club and said that it would not reopen until a reasonable system was put in place. The city and the club agreed to precisely this system, and then the city codified that so that this club and any other club would follow this system to make sure that something like this didn't happen again.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Chief, did you have anything else?
No.
In answer to Judge Karn's question about whether the APA applies to the city and the procedures that we're challenging, The answer is no. We didn't brief it, but it's rather apparent. This is not the 11th Circuit approved APA that Florida uses, which is modeled on the federal system. It is a local ordinance, and appeal is not through the usual system, for instance, up to our district courts of appeal. It's by common law certiorari, a discretionary writ, or one of the other writs such as mandamus.
Yes, which McKinney dealt with and discussed at some length.
Yes, sir. With respect to the ripeness issue, there are just a couple items I wanted to point out to the court. One is our challenges are not simply First Amendment challenges, and the case law dealing with ripeness in our circuit are not just First Amendment cases. Many of them are, because those are so important, and Wolfschlager being one of them. But Georgia Carey is an interesting one. That involved some First Amendment claims, but also some odd Second Amendment claims, and even Establishment law, Establishment Clause claims. And in that particular case, it was very similar to ours. It was a pre-enforcement action where the consequences of violating the law were very serious. And of course, the court entertained those challenges because the plaintiffs were clearly affected by that law, as is Club Madonna. The other point, kind of going to Judge Rosenbaum's inquiry, is do you actually have to violate the law in order for us to appear before the court and ask for relief? And if you think about it, that gets you into an impossible Scylla and Charybdis. If your case is not ripe without violating, we don't, under the district court's view, we would not be able to present a case. But if we did violate it and there was an active administrative case or a criminal case, then obviously Younger abstention applies. And again, we would never be able to present such an issue to the court. So when we talk about a concrete case, particularly with overwhelming facial challenges, this is the case.
Thank you. Chief, did you have anything?
No, thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.